Welcome to the Josh Bolton Show, where we dive into interesting and inspiring conversations. And now, your host, Josh Bolton.
So today we have Jeffrey Segal, a health and wellness expert, and very well versed in different things. We're going to go into different concepts of what to do post-COVID with all the staying at home and doing nothing and no gym. Here he is, Jeffrey.
Hello, everybody. And thanks, Josh, for having me on the show. I'm excited to be here and get a chance to chat and connect.
That's awesome. Thank you for coming on. Well, let's actually get right into it. The overarching problem is COVID and everyone staying at home. What is the trends you see come from this?
Yeah, there's no question that the last year has been incredibly stressful. And I was actually just reading some research published talking about people's self-reported weight gain over the last year. And we're talking 15, 20, 25 pounds. And this is self-reported, people just kind of offering up their own data. Right. And there's so many very logical reasons for this, right? One is the lack of movement, you know, being on lockdown, working from home, not having as many options to go out to gyms or to just even spend time moving around, obviously is one thing. So that sort of, you know, decreased physical activity, right? The other thing that I've talked about a lot is this idea that we shift into different phases of eating, right, to mirror different experiences that we're going through in our life. And with COVID, because there was so much fear, there was so much uncertainty, especially early on in it, right? There was so much disruption that I think a lot of people's eating patterns kind of went totally out the window. We entered into this anything goes sort of phase, which often means, you know, just sort of like eating weird things at weird times and weird amounts, right? The normal routines and schedules that we had kind of got lost. And that often put an extra strain on people's body. And then the third thing is just stress itself. I see stress as being really this hidden factor that almost universally either causes people to gain weight or prevents people from losing weight. And that's because of the effects that stress has on your body and the way that it impacts your hormones and your nervous system. It really prevents your body from getting into a place where it can efficiently burn fat, right? It really wants to hold on to calories in a different way. And it often can stimulate cravings for sugars and other things in terms of regulating your appetite and so forth. So the impact of stress, the lack of physical activity, and the disruption to people's eating patterns have been, you know, three of the big things that I've seen over this last year as really starting to undermine people's health during the pandemic.
Yeah, I can agree. Recently, I'm in LA County, so we opened up all the gyms. So I just went just to go kind of thing. Good thing I did. I guess they're going to hike all the prices because they've been closed for a year. So I'm locked in. I'm locked in at whatever price I was before. But they were the people, like, you go to the gym rats, you know that, like, they are barely 4% body fat and they should really not be pushing themselves that hard kind of thing. They got, and I go back and I see the usual gym rats and I'm like, they got love handles. They got, like, everything. And I'm sitting there going, no one left this whole pandemic unscathed.
Yeah, man. I feel what you're saying there. You know, we've all been affected and in different ways. And there's, you know, there's no question that some of us have had cushier times, you know, being able to work from home, the privilege of having a space or even maybe like a little, you know, home gym or some equipment that you can use. And, you know, beyond even just the physical piece, I think for so many people, the going to a gym or a fitness studio had a huge social element to it. And that also got taken away from us, right? Not only did we not get to see our friends or maybe even just, as you said, the gym rats, just even like the acknowledgement, that passing smile of like that person you see at the gym, you know, maybe you know their name, maybe you don't. But it's like, you know, it's those little interactions that we also got taken away from us, which is really hard. And that social isolation piece, I think, is also something that has really started to undermine people's health and people's happiness.
Yeah, I agree. Just a quick caveat on the names. literally the one I was thinking of, and we all know him, but we don't know his name. He wears a classic Slayer shirt from the 80s, freaking the old Walkman headphones. He doesn't even have a nice pair of sweatproof headphones. We just know him as the Slayer guy.
I love that. Right, like every gym has their cast of characters, and that's kind of what makes it fun. Is like you walk in, it's almost like walking into this little soap opera drama, right? It's like you can kind of know like who's going to be hanging out where, what sort of things they're going to be wearing, you know, what music they're going to be listening to, you know, and again, there's a certain familiarity to that. There's a certain routine to that I think a lot of people find comforting, you know, and it's sad that we've lost that. You know, the other piece of it that I've seen for so many people is, you know, if you are stuck at home and if you do have the privilege of working from home, right, that means like every single thing you're doing is at home, right? And the gym for so many people was this neutral place that was neither home nor work. And that was really special because it holds a unique position in our lives where we could go somewhere, right? But we weren't at home, so we didn't have all the baggage of home and family or whatever that is there. And we weren't at work, so we didn't have all the baggage and stress of work and coworkers and bosses, right? So like we're in this third place where we still knew people, right? We still had like a purpose. And I think that's been really difficult too. And so it's been interesting to see the ways in which gym culture has sort of shifted and unraveled during COVID and as people have found ways to try to like, you know, make it up on their own. And it's been hard.
It really has been. Like, I have to admit, I work night shift currently, and that in and of itself makes it hard for me to lose the body fat that I want, because essentially I'm resting, I'm not actually sleeping. So my body always thinks I'm in a state of fight or flight. But the one thing I noticed in general was, like you were saying, the overarching trend of the social interactions is the new Peloton like movement, where it's like the work from home work, but also like buy the online subscription for DDP yoga kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been so much of this, you know, and I like to say that if you had the foresight and you were lucky to invest in Peloton a year ago, right, like you probably did pretty well, right? Peloton, Mirror, Tonal, and then all of these online subscription services like Obey and these other platforms have really come to the forefront. And I think there's a lot of good that has come from that. I think a lot of people have realized that, hey, I don't need to be dependent upon a gym. I can move my body, I can exercise, I can get a really good workout in my own home. So I think there's a certain degree of freedom, a kind of like autonomy about that, which I very much support. Like I want to teach people that, like, you know, gyms are great, I freaking love them, but also like you don't need them, right? You can learn how to move your body and even do resistance training, right, without having a full gym. But as you said, there's this bit of this cultural element, right? Like you get on a Zoom call and you see somebody's like Peloton, right, chilling in the back with their like sweat rag on top of it, right? Or people are posting on their Instagram, right, their scores or something. So it's become a bit of this status symbol, a bit of this badge of honor. And that's just an interesting social phenomenon. You know, this is something I think we could talk about more in the ways in which fitness has sort of become, you know, commoditized in sometimes sort of unhealthy ways, and you know, Instagram fit celebrities and all the images that get blasted to us all the time can really be a lot.
Yeah, the social media aspect in general is like, again, the super stressful. I've actually, it's funny, I'm trying to do social stuff, but I don't like social media, so I don't use it. I also realize I'm not going to grow that quickly without using it, but it's one of those. There's a diet I saw. That's kind of when I gave up. It's like, how to do keto without keto and still get the same results? And I'm like, no, you just eat meat and eat cruciferous vegetables and you'll freaking lose body fat whether you like it or not. It's like the broccoli and chicken diet.
Yeah. And, you know, so like two things on that. One is the sort of necessary evil, you want to so call it, of like social. And I feel the same way that, you know, I it's not my favorite place to spend time. I don't love, you know, putting hours into, you know, social media stuff. But in this day and age, you know, if you're trying to grow a podcast, if you're trying to run a business online, and, you know, it's like, it is something that is just, it's important because that's where people are paying attention, people's eyes are. So it's a bit of this catch of trying to figure out like, yeah, how do you navigate this thing, recognizing that it's not something you enjoy, nor is it necessarily always leading to happiness. Like the question I ask myself whenever I put something out there, I'm like, is this helping move somebody to a place of being healthier or happier or no? right? And if the answer is no, it's like, why am I putting it out there?
Just for the likes.
For the likes, exactly. For the likes, for the clicks, for the smiles, for the reactions, for the comments, for the subscribes. You know, and that's the world we live in. And to me, that makes me like, it's a little bit sad that that's the current state of affairs. Right. And there's so much confusion, as you said, around diets, like, oh my God, there's so many freaking diets. And every time there's a new diet and there's another variation of that diet. And it's like, we've entered this world. I like to call it of dietary dogma. And I mm-hmm. think it's not only is it confusing, but it's often misleading. And then after, you know, trying a few different ones, like all the natural response is just to throw your hands up and be like, F it. Like, you know, I'm done with all this.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's where, like, for me, when I was researching diets, I typed it. This is back in like 2017. I found this guy named Vinny Tortorich. He teaches how to cut all grains and sugars out because of the insulin spike and all that. And, essentially, like he said later on, he's like, oh, I didn't realize it, but I was teaching keto, but a very specific keto. And he's like, I guess there's this whole pyramid rule. I don't know. He's like an old guy. He's like, you kids and your internet kind of thing. But, but it was just one of those. I did it for like 2 months and I literally dropped like, it was averaging about a pound a day.
Wow.
And it was That's just one pretty- of those. Yeah, it
pretty
was
pretty rapid weight loss. Yeah, how did you feel? Like how did that feel for you during that time?
Good. I had more energy, more clarity. But I guess I wasn't, because it was predominantly fat. I guess I wasn't eating enough calories in general to sustain. So like right at the 2 month mark, I'm like, oh my God, I feel like crap, kind of thing.
Mm. So then, what happened after those 2 months? Like, what did you do?
I started eating more, but it was one of those, I had to like tell myself I need to eat like a little more in general. So I introduced grains and just came right back up.
Mm. Yeah. And this, you know, Josh, like your story is so common. Like I hear this all the time where people, you know, try a new diet and it works. Like in the beginning it works. And I like to say is like, if you have a diet and you stick with it consistently, it will work. Mm-hmm. For about 8 weeks, and then it will stop working, right? Yeah. And then you need to change something, right? Because guess what? Your body has changed, right? So then I think the problem, one of the problems that we get into is thinking of diet as this sort of unitary static thing, right? But the reality is that our bodies are always changing, and so our diet always needs to be changing too. And what happens is like so many of us get stuck in eating a certain way because maybe it worked for us. Maybe it worked for us like 10 years ago. But guess what? Like our body is very different. It's not working for us right now, right? We need to update our dietary paradigms and the way we do things. And we need to constantly be fine tuning it. And that takes a lot of work. It's really hard, you know, to do that on your own.
Yeah, and I agree. There's one thing, actually, one of my coworkers, they're trying to lose weight. And because I was listening to the diet guy, they're like, what do you think? I'm like, honestly, I said, if we think, take this super primitive, not like the so many macros, so many this. Our ancestors were nomads. They didn't have pizza on the prairie kind of thing. It's like, what would they find? And it's like, you also have to remember food was scarce. So maybe they went indirectly 2 days without food. That's why we fast kind of thing.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And I like to bring that up when talking about this. Like putting it in the evolutionary context is vital. Because as you're saying, for most of human history, right, food was scarce, right? We didn't have choice in food like we have now. Mm-hmm. The situation we're in now is like evolutionarily totally crazy. It's insane, it's unprecedented. The fact that we can whip out our phones and be like, hey, what do I want to eat? Thai, Korean, burgers, pizza, versus, you know, for most of the ways in which our bodies have evolved to survive, the question was simply, is there food? Yes or no. And if there was food, you would eat it, right? If there was a lot of food, you would eat more because you weren't sure when the next meal was going to come. Or mm-hmm. maybe you would save a little bit because you weren't sure when the next meal was going to come, so you wanted to hold on to it. Right? But we would sort of naturally regulate. And as you said, maybe we'd go a few days without having a lot to eat. There was natural periods of sort of fasting and feasting, and our bodies were able to handle that pretty well, right? But now the question has changed from, is there food, yes, no, to what food and how much? And that adds in so much complexity now we're forced to decide, hey, what do I want to eat? What do I feel like? What's healthy? What did I just eat before? What am I going to eat again in 3 hours? Right? It is a much more complicated decision. And I think a lot of us, we just, you know, we're so tired. We're already so fatigued and our bodies are already so drained that we just don't have often the mental fortitude to make those decisions, at least very well. And that's where a lot of, you know, eating healthy falls apart, just because those decisions that we have to make every single day, we have to make so many food decisions, become so complicated. And so one of the reasons I think diets tend to work, especially sort of like paleo or keto diets initially, is because they simplify that decision-making process for us, right? When you get a diet, it just says you eat this and you don't eat that. And now all of a sudden, all that brain power that we needed to use to figure out what I want to eat and how much and what I'm going to eat later and next, right, gets boiled down to like, okay, I'm going to eat this. And that simplicity, I think, is something that we're all sort of craving and desiring because we live in a world that's so complex and so environmentally mismatched from the place where our bodies came from.
And another thing I told everyone, I said, one of the, it's funny because I'm a bigger guy, but I said, our ancestors back in the day, they would literally, their job wasn't to hold a little cart and put stuff on the counter. It was to run and chase elk, kill it. And that could take up to 8 hours and a shit ton of calories to get done. But then they had to prep it, which was another like 6 hours. So I'm like, it's one of those, it was a very labor intensive. I'm like, that's why we got such a huge dopamine hit when we get food, because primitively it was the hardest thing that we could do.
Yeah, I love that. I love that explanation. I love the bringing in, right, the sort of the dopamine, that reward response. So yeah, like food is inherently rewarding. And as you're saying, back in the day, it was that much more so because you had to put in a ton of effort, right, to get that food. It didn't just show up delivered to you 20 minutes after you push a button.
Right.
And so, yeah, it makes sense why food is rewarding. And it also then makes sense why, you know, some of these sort of evolutionary drives that we have, right, towards that using food as a reward now in the modern context that we're living in are actually working against us. Right. And lead to things like food sort of dependency and addiction or emotional eating or just using food as a coping mechanism because it does feel good. And a lot of times we don't feel very good the rest of our day.
Yeah. It's a 9-to-5 job. Everyone's soul is slowly dying. It's like, I'll just eat a little thing of Oreos and then one Oreo equals like the whole damn tray.
Yes, this is so true. It's something that I think this experience pretty much everybody has had, those times where of kind of mindlessly munching. Again, one bite leads to many bites because we use food, as I like to say, as a symbolic substitute for something else, right? In the case of the Oreos, you know, maybe what you're really hungry for is just this sense of relaxation, the sense of letting go of stress, the sense of your body just finally settling down and feeling comfortable. But what you're using the food for is a tool, right? Is a way to kind of get that feeling. But no number of Oreos can ultimately satisfy that for you, right? And yes. And after you eat the whole box, guess what? It actually ends up making things worse, right? Because now your belly doesn't feel great and your digestion is all messed up and you beat yourself up over it, right? And so that's a whole extra layer of stress that we put on ourselves.
It really is. And working where I do, I work for a grocery store. So it's one of those, one of the veggie guys, because he was getting some organic like apples out. And I'm like, oh, like the apples look really good today. So he jokingly picks up the apple and scrapes it and white stuff come off. And I'm like, what the hell is that shit? He's like, it's wax. It's edible wax. He's like, you think these apples are actually good? He's like, this whole store, it's all genetically modified. It's super fake.
I love the like that experience, right? The wax on the apple, right? And I think the word that stands out for me is fake. Mm-hmm. Right? The food that we get. And I'm going to say this from this sort of like, right, like the American centric, right? You walk into like, I'm not going to pick on particular supermarket brands. And I don't know who you work for, but like, you know, you walk
as
into
long as
like
they don't say their name, I'm good.
Okay. Yeah. We walk into a supermarket, right? And it's like you said, it's like you pick up this apple. You're like, oh, this apple looks great. Right. And I'm not saying that the apple isn't great, but as you're like, you know, yes, the apple is coated in food grade wax. guess what might also be on that wax, right? Different types of pesticides, different types of herbicides, all sorts of chemicals that they might spray on the tree. And as you said, that apple isn't just an apple that just sort of haphazardly grew in somebody's backyard. That apple has been cultivated deliberately, right, through science and engineering to be this most sort of like perfect apple that we can possibly imagine, right? But sometimes what we do is that we make it as big and as colorful as we can, but we actually lose some of the vitamins and nutrients in it, right? It's just like the similar things happen with livestock, is like we pump it full of hormones so it grows nice and fat and big so we can get more meat from it, but the actual meat is less nutritious, right, than a smaller, you know, animal that maybe was living off of the land differently. And so, yeah, we have modified our environment and our whole food chain, our whole food system has become very, very fake and often very unhealthy. And that's, again, another sort of piece of this health and wellness puzzle.
It is. And like the biggest one I've noticed, I used to have chickens. So we would get the fresh eggs every day.
Nice. And, that's awesome.
And they grew full size, and it was one of those, one of them liked jumping on my knee. So I looked at him like, you know, it's weird to say, but your breasts are way smaller than the ones at the store, kind of thing. And I just sat there and I'm like, huh. So I did some research. Apparently they pump them full of saline and water.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, fake food, you know. And fake might be a little bit of a stretch. I do think there are certainly fake foods out there, right? Like you get some sort of, you know, I can't believe it's not butter, right? With, you know, which is this the craziest product ever. And let me tell you why it's so crazy is that like you look on the back and you read the nutrition label and guess what? And it says 0 calories. And you're like, oh, wow, this thing that kind of tastes like butter is 0 calories. Guess what? I'm just going to use it and I'm going to dump it over everything. Mm-hmm. Right? And then you go and you read the ingredients, right? The ingredients are water, buttermilk, soybean oil. Like that thing is actually probably contains hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of calories, but there's a loophole because according to the FDA, right, serving sizes can be measured in such a way that anything less than a half a gram can be rounded down to zero. So the serving size on the I Can't Believe It's Not Butter is like 3 pumps, which is like 1 gram, and maybe that has a half a gram of fat in it, but they can get away with saying it has 0 grams of fat in it, which means it has 0 calories just because we're talking about 3 pumps of the little spray. And so it's like, you know, it's like when you start looking deeper into the products and the labeling, it's so easy to see like, oh my God, like the food that we're eating isn't what we think it is.
No. Not at all. So actually, I want to touch on something, the Impossible Burger. What's your take on it?
So I've tried Impossible Burgers and Beyond Meat, and I know there's a few other brands. And, you know, I'm kind of torn on this. On one hand, I think it's wonderful that there are like meat alternative foods out there. I do think I'm not against eating meat. I personally eat meat. I think actually eating meat from small scale farms that do regenerative agriculture is actually really wonderful, is a really healthy thing for the environment, for the animals. And also I think it can be for your body, but I recognize not everybody wants to eat meat and that's also okay. So having alternatives is fine. You know, again, when we start getting into the fake foods, like, you know, it always sort of weirded me out. You know, I've had friends who have been vegetarians for years, long before there was an Impossible Burger, right? There was Seitan, which is, you know, kind of a soy-based meat substitute. And I would go to my friend's house and he would have like a Seitan turkey or Seitan chicken fingers, or I'm from Philly, they'd have like a Seitan cheesesteak. And it was always weird to me. I'm like, why do you want to like mimic this thing? Like, you know, why do you want to eat this plant thing to taste like chicken if you're a vegetarian and you don't like chicken? Like,
right.
You know, it's like, right. There always seemed to be a little bit of this odd disconnect there. Like, why are you trying to make this thing taste like something that it's not?
Exactly.
Right. So that to me is a sign of something being off. Right. So we're using our technology in a way, right, to kind of shape shift. And whenever we do that, I think we get further away from what our bodies are used to doing and knowing. As you said, our bodies grew up in a context of like we ate basic whole foods from the earth, from the grounds in their original shape and their original form. Right. And now we've gone to this place where there's so much processing. Right. There's so much human intervention. That Impossible Burger, even if it's made from wholesome, you know, plants, all right, in a way that doesn't necessarily impact the environment as much or lead to animal suffering. It's still been processed a ton to get to this thing that looks like a beef patty that tastes kind of like a burger, right? And so you have to question, like, were all those steps in between really healthy, right? And then you start looking at the macros and the other stuff, and you ask, well, you know, macronutriently, like, it's probably a similar amount of calories. It might even be similar amounts of fat, because I know a lot of them use like coconut oil, and that has a lot of saturated fat. And you're like, well, you know, that Impossible Burger has just as much saturated fat as the regular burger. And it's like, so why am I eating one and not the other? I think the matter is just like, just looking a little bit deeper into it. I think whenever you stop at the surface level and just say, oh, Impossible Burger, that's a plant-based burger, that's automatically better, right? That's a sign of being a little bit lazy. I think we all need to go that extra step and be more critical consumers.
I agree. And especially, it's a recent phenomenon when I was looking up all this stuff, but the soy, how it greatly affects both male and female. And the more, it's like this one vegan guy I knew, he was using Impossible Burger. And it was just like through a timeline, we watched him kind of thing on YouTube. And suddenly he had sharp, like chest, like chiseled everything. And then suddenly he started getting bitch tits. And he's like, and he's like, I don't understand. I'm working out. I'm eating clean. And essentially someone was like, dude, you're eating a shit ton of soy. Your body is literally turning you into a woman now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, soy can certainly have those effects on those body. And so like that, you know, when you think about the Impossible Burger or any food like that, it's important to examine it in all of these lenses, right? So you start like, you know, ethically, okay, like if you're against animal cruelty or killing animals or eating animals, then I understand that yes, eating some plant-based item is probably going to be the way to go, right? But then you go to the next layer and you say, okay, environmentally, what's the difference between these two things? What's the environmental impact, right, of a hamburger versus an Impossible Burger? And the answer is, it depends. It depends on whether that burger is coming from a conventional like feedlot, right, which is probably not very good for the environment at all, or whether, as we said, it's coming from a smaller farm, you know, grass-fed cows doing regenerative agriculture. And I've read, too, that, you know, when you ask, where is the plants coming from, right? Is it coming from monocropping of soy that's also sprayed with a lot of different chemicals? Because guess what? That can also be bad for the environment. That can also be very water-intensive types of agriculture and farming, right? So it's like the environmental trade-off isn't always so clear as we think it is, right? And then we go to the next level, as we talked about, of like macronutrients, and you look at, okay, you know, what are the compounds in it? When you look at fats and proteins, when you look at vitamins and minerals, how do these two things stack up, right? And then you go to the next level of flavor. Well, like, how does it taste? Like, you know, you don't want to eat something that you don't like that tastes crappy, right? Even if it's maybe marginally healthier for you, right? You know, that has to come into play. And then the piece of cost, right? A lot of the Impossible Burgers meat stuff, like, they're way more expensive than at least the conventionally grown beef, right? And so that's going to come into play too, because now all of a sudden, right, it becomes a privilege. It becomes a privilege of those who can afford it, right, to eat these plant-based substitutes. And now we've got this whole issue of inequity and economic disparity that comes into play. So, like, complexity, complexity, complexity.
It really is. And so one thing, like, was during the heat of the lockdown or right before it last year, everyone was talking about dieting and veganism and how animal farming is cruelty and all that shit. And essentially, I looked up at one of my coworkers. He was thinking of going vegan. I said, let's put it this way. Are you comfortable killing thousands of creatures for your little plant burger? He's like, thousands don't die. I'm like, pesticides. Complete genocide of all the insects. That's thousands that I know of right there. Then they set traps so they kill the fox, so the fox can't steal the soy. So that's thousands of deaths compared to one death of a cow. So I'm like, think about it. I'm like, if anything, this crop is more dangerous because, like you were saying, pesticides, this, the water labor. A cow, well, it's a cow. My aunt has a property in Idaho. They're going to start a whole cow farm. They're going to get like 50 of them. They got 700 plus acres to run the cows. So it's like there's no excuse. They can run the cows out there because winter, it truly is snowing. They got to buy alfalfa for them.
Yeah. And you raise a really good point and of the ways in which diets are such a big thing for our world and our culture right now, I think actually is a tale of two different, there's two sides to this. One is the health side, of like, I'm going to be a vegan or I'm going to go paleo because I think it's healthier for my body. That's one perspective. But I think the other thing is a lot of diets become identity labels, right? It's like, we all know that gluten-free guy or that paleo guy or that vegan guy or gal, right? That's like, right. That's like, doesn't shut up about it. Right. Like they're always chatting and, you know, they're trying to like push their beliefs. They, you know, you become like evangelical. And I use that word specifically because I think this is actually a symptom of, you know, the ways in which religion has really sort of, you know, faded to the background from where it used to be in our culture as it's become more secular and more scientific and younger generations are maybe a little less involved in religion. Like, I think the new religion is these religions of different dietary dogmas. In the same way that somebody says, like, I'm a Protestant or a Baptist or a Catholic, people say, I'm a vegan, I'm paleo, I'm gluten-free, right? Just like, because there's a sense of belonging, there's a sense of identity, there's a sense of, I'm doing this for these sort of righteous reasons that are bigger than myself. And so I see it as psychologically, it's actually fulfilling a similar sort of mechanism. And I think that's just a fascinating lens to look at this through.
It is. And on top of, just going to touch a little on it, then we can get back to the health, the whole event, the religion aspect, rejecting old former to new. At times, I've noticed this with cancel culture online. It seems like a religion now. It's not just like we're fighting for the little guy. It's a full on like the shame you kind of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you bring up cancel culture. There's a lot of ways and that the internet, right, has enabled the spread of these kind of subcultural identities very quickly, right? Mm-hmm. Where something can kind of, right, it can disseminate, this information can spread so quickly, right, through the whole country, the whole nation, the whole world, and people can pick up on it and join into it, right? And you see these movements rise, and the thing is they rise really quickly, but then they also fall really quickly, right? And then people are on to the next thing because our attention is so fickle. And we're so distracted, right? And we're always just waiting for that next thing and that next thing. And again, and just another sort of classic, is you can call it an observation. You could call it a symptom of the world that we're living in.
Yeah, I agree. It's a very interesting thing. Just a side note, for the flat earthers, I thought that shit died back in like the 80s and 90s. Like, no one actually did that, but apparently they're back.
I thought that shit died back in like in, you know, the 1500s when people were sailing around the world and realized that, oh, I got back to where I started. But you know what? It's some beliefs die hard.
They do.
You know, and this is, it's interesting to think about the ways in which ideas come and go, right? And scientific paradigms and other things often say, you know, so many of the most important scientific you know, revelations, just the idea that the earth revolves around the sun, as opposed to the sun revolving around the earth, right? That was this brand new idea. And everybody thought it was crazy, right? It was like Copernicus was deemed a heretic until more and more evidence. Finally, people start to kind of begrudgingly accept it. And then after another generation or two, now it's considered self-evident. And so I think this is sort of the ways in which ideas go through this life cycle of often being rejected and slowly incorporated into the mainstream, and then everybody brushes it off and takes it for granted. But that doesn't mean that the other idea is totally dead. It's lingering somewhere out there in the periphery.
That annoying uncle in the corner.
You know, and not to shift totally directions, but, you know, that brings up a whole nother conversation, right, about misinformation and fake news and the ways in which you know, we're surrounded by a lot of ideas and a lot of facts that aren't really grounded in reality. And again, because of the internet world, like, these things can live and survive and be transmitted really quickly. And that enables them to stick around.
It really does. And this is tying in earlier with the Instagram saying we're keto, but not keto. It's like, how do you do that kind of thing?
Yeah, you know, and it's like everybody puts their own spin on it, and everybody wants to have the new version because that's easier to sell.
It is.
Yeah.
So going back to the fake food in general, so I've recently gotten a bug for growing vegetables because I'm more observant than most, so I'm watching like prices tick up 10 cents here, 10 cents there, kind of thing. It's small; no one's going to notice it at first. So I'm like, I bet you in a year it's going to be a freaking fortune to buy just a little carrot. But if I start now, I could have a whole crop of carrots kind of thing. So I'm trying that out. But I've also noticed when I grow my food, so much more tastier.
Yes, yes. I kind of had a feeling you were going to say that. I'm a huge proponent of growing your own food and a huge proponent of cooking your own food. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, hey, start with the cooking, because I think for a lot of people,
that's the hardest part.
You're not even, you're not there yet. And that's okay. I get that that's a skill that maybe you've never really been taught. Maybe you didn't have much exposure to, you don't learn it. So it's not your fault. But I do think it's like one of the best things that you can do for your health is to learn how to cook.
Yes.
Right? That's step number one. And so, I'm not saying don't eat out. I freaking love eating out. My wife and I are total foodies, but that's a privilege. It's something we look forward to. It's a special occasion, and most of the meals during the week are meals that we cook on our own. I live in the city. I don't have a huge backyard, but I still grow vegetables in little containers because, as you said, it's fun. I like it. I like the gardening aspect. I like growing my own food. When I do grow it, it tastes a hell of a lot better. There's something so satisfying about eating a tomato or a pepper in a salad and recognizing like, hey, I grew this thing. I watered it. I took care of it. Now I'm chopping it up and I'm putting it in, right? And it, as you said, it goes back to like, it makes the food rewarding, but it's rewarding now in this much deeper way. There's a much deeper fulfillment about that meal than me, hitting the button on Uber Eats and getting a salad delivered by, right? I have no idea who made that salad. I have no idea who made it. I have no idea where the ingredients came from. I have no idea who grew those ingredients, right? It's like unknown, unknown, unknown. And I'm putting this thing into my body. That unknown is now becoming, right? My nourishment is becoming the building blocks for my cells. And I think like it's a weird thought to think that it's like, hey, like I'm going to take something that I know almost nothing about and put it in my body. Like we're giving up a lot of our power when we do that.
Yes. So one thing I always remember this, but I had it last night, is McDonald's fries. You know how they're done?
I don't.
So one of my buddies, actually his restaurant closed because of COVID. He couldn't sustain. But he was telling me he was buying a plot in a potato farm in California. And he saw this big plot over to the right, and he asked, like, hey, why can't I get that one? It looks like it's cheaper. And they're like, oh, that's McDonald's. And he's like, okay. He's like, so what's the difference? They're like, oh, we literally bomb that thing with so much pesticides and controlling agents that it's not inhabitable for 2 weeks for humans. And he's like, well, if a human can't go in for 2 weeks, why should a plant grow in there then? He's like, because it literally grows to the exact size for the machine. No more, no less. And I'm like, and after he said that, I was eating some fries, and I'm like, well, this chemical hodgepodge, just threw it aside.
Yeah, and when you begin to know this, right, when you begin to educate yourself a little bit, you can see these things, and you're like, oh, yeah, like, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, right? Mm-hmm. And, there was that movie years ago, right, what is it, Super Size Me?
Yeah.
There's a lot of good documentaries out there that try to shed some light on the ways in which our modern agricultural practices have gone astray. And I just want to caveat that real quick for a second, okay, because, because I appreciate you, Josh, of like taking this evolutionary lens, right? We're talking about like for most of human history, we hunted, we gathered, we didn't have a lot of food. So I do think there is something to be said that like at this point in time, like we can grow enough food to feed the billions of people on this planet. Like it's the Absolutely. Ways in which agriculture, right, has enabled us to productively grow food is amazing. It has prevented a lot of malnourishment. I know there still are obviously millions of people who are malnourished, but like it has helped uplifted a lot of humans out of poverty just because we have farming practices that are useful at growing food. So I don't want to discount that. I think that's important to acknowledge that has been a benefit to humanity. However, the dark side of that, right, as you're saying, is that sometimes it becomes too much, too extreme, and like the use of chemicals and the ways in which we're farming are too intensive that we're actually just degrading the earth that we depend upon.
Yes, and it's one of those also as things go on, especially with COVID and the you're touching, we make enough food to technically feed everyone, but it's the distribution. We saw that with the initial lockdowns.
Right.
We definitely saw it in my grocery store. It's like the whole store was empty and we're just like, where the – we're literally – there's hundreds of millions of pounds of crops right now. Where is it kind of thing?
Yeah, yes. It's so fascinating that you had that firsthand experience in the grocery store, right, during, you know, rewind a year ago and seeing all that happen, right? And like, I remember going too to my supermarket and yeah, the shelves being empty. And I'm like, man, I never saw that, right? And I was never used to seeing that. Maybe a little bit, you know, I live up in New England. So like whenever we get a big blizzard coming, yeah, you know, like people would, everybody would stock up on all those like pantry staples, but like not to the extent that we had, right? Where it's like, you couldn't, there were certain things like you couldn't get for a little while. And that's, you know, it's interesting because that sort of limitation and scarcity is something that most of us who grew up, you know, in the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years in the US, like aren't really used to, because our food system has become so globalized and our food chains and delivery systems are so robust that like, you know, we're used to having pretty much all the food all the time. Whereas in the past, it's like, you know, we would get things seasonally and some things like if you couldn't get it, it's because nobody was growing it nearby. Right. Or, you know, and we've lost touch with that seasonality of our food as well, because we ship things in from Canada and from Mexico and from Chile and from China. And so it doesn't really matter. It's like you can always get fresh blueberries. Right. But what's the cost to that? Right. What's the, you know, because, hey, hey, how are they growing it in China? You have absolutely no idea what sort of chemicals or things are, right? And then B, how much energy, fossil fuels, human labor does it take to get that tiny little pint of blueberries, right, from China to your supermarket?
Right? Tons. And if, they have to do it by ship. They can't do it by plane.
Yeah, so you put on a ship, right? And then from the ship, it has to get offloaded onto a truck. And then from the truck, it gets driven to the market. And now you know what happens there. Then you got to pick it up and you got to put it on the shelf, right?
And so it's like back.
Let me, you know, there's a practice I like to do before I eat. And it's just taking a moment where I take a couple of deep breaths and I just mentally kind of acknowledge, right, like all of these steps that it took to get this food from where it was grown in the earth to my plate. Right. And I'm just imagining, like, you know, the farmers that grew it, right, the water, the earth, the sunshine, right, the person, as you said, that picked it or the machine that picked it. Right, the ships and the trucks that it went on, the person in the supermarket that put it on the shelf, the other person that scanned the item to put it in my bag, right? It's like it's passed through so many hands and so many people. So I just try to take a moment to acknowledge that, and it just helps me be a little bit more respectful of, again, the food, where it comes from, and what I'm putting in my body.
Yes, I agree. And like the biggest one I've noticed, and it's a huge cartel now with the avocado industry. My grandfather used to have a huge avocado tree. Like, we had the kind of crops where, like, we were just handing 5-gallon buckets to people. Like, we can't eat this all. Like, take it kind of thing. But we only had that window between September and October. That was it. Then all the avocados were gone. We, like, had to figure out ways to save it kind of thing. And that's where then I jokingly told my grandfather, I'm like, well, if you can get avocados only between September and October, how are they getting avocados on the shelves all year round kind of thing? And he said, essentially, in Mexico, it's perfect. They always produce kind of thing. He's like, whether we like it or not.
Right. Right. You know? And so look, I'm not against free trade, right? Cause you can make the argument that, hey, the farmers in Mexico, right, have this product that they can grow all the time. And there are consumers in the US that want that product. So yeah, let's set it up so we can ship them across, right? Like, you know, so it makes economic sense, you know, in one way. But when you look at it again from just the health lens, and more so, I think the issue is like the dependency, right? Because now when we've gotten used to like having a perfectly ripe avocado 24/7, 365, the minute that we don't have that avocado, like we feel pissed off, we're frustrated, right? Because it's like, oh, look at me, like I'm so entitled that I want my avocado, you know, I don't know if you've ever had to deal with somebody in the supermarket, right? Like freaking out because they're asking, hey, where's my avocados?
Yes, right? Actually. It's surprising, 6 a.m. right when we open, there's everyone and their mother comes in and just starts screaming. It's like, did you have your coffee yet? Did you think this through?
You know, and I love the fact that you work at a supermarket because I really think that, you know, our nation's health, if they're, and I've joked about this before. I'm like, you know, I'm not a public health expert, although this is something that I care deeply about. But I'm like, you know, if you really want to start to make a difference in our nation's health, you should have a health coach and a nutrition counselor and a psychologist at the front of every grocery store. So the when that person walks in, you have these three people walking with you to counsel you on, hey, why are you choosing that thing? Why not that thing? What are you going to make for dinner? Why are you cooking? Like, you know, it's like, because like there, so much of our health begins or ends with the items that we pick up in the supermarket.
It really does. And actually, have you followed Japan in general for their food?
I've actually spent some time in Japan just visiting as a tourist, but I'm not specifically. So tell me more about what you're thinking of.
So what it is there was this YouTuber did a 30-minute comparison. It was actually worth the 30 minutes. I don't even remember the video, and probably YouTube will never give it back to me. But it was comparing how Japan made one simple distinction different from us. They said, all food on the counter, if claimed to be real, must be real. That's it.
And what sort of impact did that have?
Well, it's like you were there. When you ate there, you probably lost a solid 2-3 pounds, even though you were eating a shit ton of rice and like veggies. It was that's the only distinction. If it's you say it's real, a real like asparagus, it has to be real. It can't be the GMO stuff.
Gotcha. So this was like a distinction on like genetically modified versus non, right?
Pretty much, And they also encouraged local farmers instead of global farmers.
Yeah. You know, I mean, look, I'm not out here to like demonize genetically modified food. I think there are certain things that are potentially beneficial again from genetic modification. I do think eating local food, right, as we talked about, local seasonal food is just, there's no question it's going to be better for our biology because our bodies evolved in a certain way to eat what we could gather, right, what we could walk or run or pick up, right, which means, guess what, it's going to be local and it's going to be seasonal. You know, and I've been fortunate. I've gotten to do a lot of travel. I've spent many years actually living abroad in Asia. And, you know, what you're saying about the food in other countries, I think is true. Like the U.S. is this really unique place because it is like no other country in terms of the variety of foods that we have to offer. The number of different types of cuisines, the number of different types of restaurants is really unprecedented. I don't think there's any other country that can rival the U.S. with that, right? But the flip side of that, again, the dark side is the amount of fake, highly processed kind of junk, right, food that we have is insane, right? The food that, right? And so it's like, it's sort of really split. It's like, yeah, you can go to a nice high-end restaurant, you can get really good, high-quality ingredients and food, but the majority of our food world that we live in here in the States is a whole bunch of this other stuff. And this other stuff isn't so good for our bodies.
It's not. And it's really sad. Like something super simple. So the plants behind me, I'm growing them in water. And it's a type of, do you know what aquaponics is?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a type of aquaponics. And it's just, as I'm watching, it's literally in 2 days has doubled its size just on the tip.
Love it.
And I'm just, and it's one of those, I'm like, it's not water intensive. It's whatever I have. Yes. Perfect.
I have lots of plants over here.
Yeah, I'm seeing all the stuff around you.
Yeah, we have a ton of plants in our home, you know. You know, which goes back to another consideration. We're talking about health and wellness, right? I read something that, like, you know, most Americans spend 90% of their waking hours indoors. Now, obviously, this varies a lot depending on the climate that you live in, of course, you know. But like 90% of the time is like you are inside this little climate controlled drywall box. And what does that mean? That means you are separated from nature. You are separated from plants and trees. You are separated from sunlight, which is so important for vitamin D and for other things, for regulating your circadian rhythms, right? And you're exposed to indoor air pollution, which sometimes can even be worse than outdoor air pollution. Right? And so the ways in which, again, we've cut ourselves off from the earth and from the environment also slowly begins to degrade our health. And so, like, you know, it goes back to the growing your own food. Even just having a couple of houseplants is something that can boost your mood and really begin to just like reconnect you to nature.
Absolutely. I agree with that. Yeah. Especially in definitely in the heat of lockdown. This is before I started this whole tank thing. I noticed like I would go in, sit, like the, I work night shift. So I try to avoid the sun like it's the plague because it wakes me up. But I would just step out just to get a breath air. And I'm like, wow, it's like a whole chest weight just came off me. Like, so I would walk around the backyard, get some air, go back in, hour later, go back outside. And it's like, wow, that chest weight's back kind of thing. That's where I'm like, maybe it's the actual house kind of thing with the airflow. And that's where I just looked into all the different stuff.
Yeah, it's a really interesting observation. And I like what you're saying, like that chest weight. I think when we start to notice our bodies, pay attention a little bit more, right? One of the easiest signals that we can pick up on is that sort of that feeling of heaviness versus that feeling of lightness. Mm-hmm. And that can tell us so much, just that distinction. Right? When something makes us feel heavy, right, it's weighing us down, kind of literally and metaphorically, like it's usually a sign that something is wrong, something is off, something is maybe unhealthy, dysfunctional. It's not working for us, it's sort of working against us. Versus when something makes us feel lighter, that's usually a sign that that thing is probably going to be wholesome and nourishing. Yes. Right? And that thing can be a food, as you said, it could be just stepping outside and getting a breath of fresh air. Sometimes it's a conversation. You know, you have a conversation with somebody, like you should pause at the end of that conversation and ask yourself, do I feel heavier or do I feel lighter? Right? If you feel heavier, right, maybe it's because there was a lot of difficult, stressful, emotional stuff going on. Like that was a hard conversation, right? If you feel lighter, it's because like there was that, it was fun, it was playful, right? There was that resonance, you could feel each other, and it leaves you with this feeling of lightness. And I think so much of us, all we're really desiring when it comes to our health is that feeling of lightness, is that lightness of being, is that feeling of like being alive and being energized and being happy to be here.
Yes, no, I agree. Like one of my coworkers, it's every day. I can tell if he's there because everyone's dragged down kind of thing. That's where I jokingly tell him, like, because he always complains. He's like, oh, life sucks. I need a beer, this and that. And it's like, dude, are you just trying to piss us all off and drain our souls so you feel better? You know, the misery likes company kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And ever since I pointed that out, and he's like, oh, you guys are like sad? We're like, yes. He's like, oh, that's never been my intent. I want you guys happy, not me. Mm. I'm like, then stop talking about your shit.
It reminds me of a quote, and I don't remember it precisely, but it's something along the lines that our greatest human addiction is constantly talking about our stress and our problems.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think for some people, as you're pointing out, this guy, right, like it really does become an addiction. And again, it's not necessarily his fault. Like, you know, maybe he never learned healthier ways to cope. Right. And a lot of us are hurting. A lot of us are struggling and dealing with some hard stuff. And it's like, we don't know what to do with it. So we just share it because it's like, it's too much for us to hold on to. So it's like, here, you take some of it, right? Like we need each other's help. But like, obviously, you know, there are productive ways to do that. And then there are unproductive ways to do that.
Like the productive way was actually admitting, like, you need to go to a therapist. Just not even for therapy, just to talk to someone that won't judge you kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and maybe this guy doesn't have right somebody in his life that he can talk to, that he can get some of that, you know, validation and compassion from. And I think that's unfortunate. You know, that's the value of close friendships and good relationships. Like, you know, we all need somebody that we can turn to when we're having a rough day and just be like, hey, man, like, let me just vent for a second. Right. And just know that we're not going to be judged and they're still going to be there for us at the end of that. That's really important.
It really is. Yeah. There's always that one guy or gal you can call and know they'll drop whatever they're doing, listen to what you say. And then at the end, they'll be like, okay, you're an idiot, but here's why.
All right. Or you're an idiot and I still love you. And I love you because you're an idiot. And I still going to be your friend. Right. Like that's the sort of, right. That's the friendship that you want. Cause you know that like, there's that unbreakable bond, right. They're there for you. Even right. They're there for you at your worst. They're there for you at your best. Right. That is loyalty. That's good stuff, you know, and there are some people out there that don't have that. And then, you know, you look at what's going on. And, you know, it just like the shootings, the killings, right? Like all these things, like, you know, I can only help but to imagine that those people, right, don't have anybody like that in their lives, right? So like what happens to all that anger, all that emotion that they can't handle, gets bottled up until one day it comes out through a gun and causes a hell of a lot of suffering.
Yes, but also there was that one point back in like 18 and 19 where like there was a gun shooting every week. So people, maybe they wouldn't have normally done it, but it was because it was so, they got their 15 minutes of fame. Like, well, I wonder if I do it, I get my minutes of fame kind of thing.
Yeah. And I feel like this is definitely a topic that probably deserves more time than we have to give it right now. You know, it's yeah. like the psychology of mass shooters and is complex. And there's definitely this idea of being in the spotlight of, you know, of wanting attention. Like, because I do think it goes back to like all of us to a certain extent, like we want attention. We need attention from others. And again, there are healthy ways of asking for attention and there are extremely destructive ways of doing that.
Yeah. It's like, I'm paraphrasing the whole quote, but essentially you are who you associate with. So if you associate with toxicity and friends are negative and tearing you down, well, then you will become that. So if like, you want to be successful, you need to associate with business people kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, I think the similar idea is like you are the average of the five people that you spend the most time with.
Yes.
Right. And I think that just points directly at the ways in which all of us are so impacted by our relationships. We're so affected by the social fabric that we live in, right? And the ways it can impact us can be really helpful or not so much. And so it does require a little bit of discernment, right? And sometimes you might need to distance yourself from somebody, right? And that can be tricky too, because if it's somebody that you've known for a long time and somebody that you care about, it's like, you know, you don't want to abandon them, but you also need to respect yourself. You need to set boundaries. I talk a lot about boundaries as being one of the four pillars of self-care, right? It's like until we set that boundary of saying, hey, like, you know, it's like this, I'm drawing that line in the sand, right? And it's like, if you cross that line, then I'm going to have to turn the other way because that's too much. And it's like, I can't sacrifice my own well-being, right, to take on all of that extra stuff that you're putting out there.
I have to agree. So then can we go into the four pillars and then do you have to head off?
Yeah, we can go into that. So, you know, I talk a lot about this idea of like a self-care chair, which is sort of the metaphor that I use for self-care. But, you know, the chair's got four legs, right? The four pillars. And I like to say it's great if you have all four of these things, right? If you have three, you're probably doing okay. But if you had two, you're going to topple. And that's usually when things hit the fan and aren't going so well, right? So the four pillars, like I said, one is boundaries, all right? Another one is perspectives. Another one is tools. And then another one is strategies. And I can go into each of those in a little bit more detail, right? And so we talked a little bit about the boundaries, right? That just being very clear about, you know, where are you drawing that line for yourself, right? And just making sure that at the end of the day, like you are protecting what's vital for you. You are protecting your own well-being and you're not letting somebody else constantly step on your toes or constantly dump all of their stuff on you. Right? And that doesn't mean that you don't care. It doesn't mean that you can't help, but it's like there's some clear boundaries there. And boundaries can be kind of physical in terms of like space boundaries, like especially working from home or if you share your home with other people. Like I think having physical boundaries is important, but often boundaries are invisible. And I think a lot of problems for most people is that A, they never communicate them, or B, they never protect them. Right. And so like you could put boundaries and say like, hey, I'm going to like put this in my calendar. This is like my exercise time. Right. So like you set up this sort of boundary, like by putting something in your calendar, you're putting a boundary around that time saying I'm going to do this with that time. But a lot of times you don't protect that boundary and we let other things creep in and take away from it. Right. So protecting our boundaries requires some confidence and some courage. And that's important. The next thing is perspectives. And so this has to do with perspective taking or seeing things from different angles, from different viewpoints, right? So if you're having a really crappy day, right, that's like your friend coming in and being like, hey, man, I know you're having a crappy day, but like, you know, have you ever thought about it from this perspective? Like, you know, like what would somebody, you know, who's, you know, grandmother just died have to say? Like, is it really crappy compared to that? And like, I'm not trying to get caught in suffering, but it's like, it's just taking a different perspective of your day. right? Or whatever is going on for you. And I think sometimes all we need is just that perspective shift. We need to stop getting in our own sucky victim, oh, pity, poor me mindset. And we need to pull ourselves out of that and just take a different viewpoint. So having the ability to take different perspectives is another important thing for taking care of ourselves, right? The third thing would be tools. And so these tools can be really like tangible tools, right? Like self-care tools. And like, maybe that's like your pair of running shoes, you know, maybe that's like a yoga mat. Maybe that's your favorite perfume or cologne. Like these are certain things that you can use that, you know, are going to enable you, things that empower you, right, to take care of your health and your well-being. Right. They can also be practices like meditation or mindfulness or just like taking a couple deep breaths. Right. That's a tool. That's like a resource, an inner resource that you have. So the tools are things that you can draw upon when you need them. Right. So it's like if you're like suiting up for a journey, it's like, what are you going to pack in your bag? Right. Those are the tools. And everybody has different tools and you need different tools for different types of stressors. But it's like the more tools you have in your self-care toolkit, the better off you're going to be.
Absolutely.
And then the fourth one is strategies. And this is like, if you know, right, this is the like, you know, going into Thanksgiving dinner with the family, right? It's like, yeah. What's your game plan, right, for that? Like, if you know you're going to enter into a stressful situation, if you know you're going to enter into some sort of challenge, it's like, do you have a game plan, right? Do you have an intention? Do you have a strategy that's going to help you navigate through that? Right, in a way where you can take care of yourself and hopefully, you know, not cause any harm to anybody else. And so I think those four things, like when you have all of those in place, the boundaries, the strategies, the tools, and the perspectives, it's like you have a really robust foundation for taking care of yourself. But the problem is when we lose some of those things, right, it's like we don't respect our boundaries. We don't have a lot of tools because maybe we haven't really learned a lot of techniques for taking care of ourselves. We knock out another leg. Right. And then we don't have maybe we don't have people to talk to. Like we don't have an opportunity to shift that mindset, to shift our perspective. Boom. So now we're standing on just one of those four legs and our self-care is very fragile. And I think that's when people start to burn out and fall apart and our health and our physically and mentally really starts to degrade.
It really does. And it's the bigger complexity is, like you said, it's we were always taught one leg. You make it work out, just sheer iron will and you'll get it done. But there's a bigger problem at play. You need more feet on the ground kind of thing.
Yeah. I that piece of like you're taught to just muscle through it, right? It's like just get it done, just figure it out, just keep pushing. You know, and yeah, there are times and places for that. There's definitely a time for being really gritty and persevering and just kind of pushing through it. However, when you do that day after day after day after day, right, it's not a sustainable strategy. And I think that difference, right, between like a short-term solution and a long-term sustainable self-care practice, right, like there's a big difference in there. And so my work, what I most hope is to try to teach people, it's like, how can we move away from the sort of simple short-term fixes into a place where you can have this sort of like long-term sustainable health and wellness?
So on that very good note, where can all the guests get in contact with you?
Yeah. So the best way to find me is just online at my website, Jeff Siegel Wellness, Siegel spelled S-I-E-G-E-L. You can find me on Instagram at Jeff Siegel Wellness. You can find me on Facebook at Jeff Siegel Wellness, basically all over social. Okay. Just Google Jeff Siegel Wellness. You should pop that up. And so, yeah, sign up for my newsletter. I send out a couple times a month with articles, interviews, different things that I'm writing and putting out there.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Jeff. We definitely got to get you on in the future.
Josh, thank you so much. I appreciate all of your comments, all of your sharing and personal experience. And yeah, it's really interesting to hear. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeff. Stay safe and stay well.
Well, congratulations, you made it to the end. You are an awesome person. Not many make it here. So, being the awesome person that you are, can you do me one more awesome favor? Can you rate and review this on whatever podcast services you're using? If you do it on Apple and you leave an actual written review, I have a thing on my website. I will take your written review and post it for all to see. Congratulations, you're permanently sealed on my site. Otherwise, I am trying to do YouTube more and live streaming. I will try to put as many of the YouTube links in the description of the show as I can. So give your boy some extra help over on YouTube. Watch my videos. I just mute it and change the channel, change the window or something. But yeah, that's it. Thank you for being awesome and see you next time.